Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS-FM and WETS-HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. You know, when the framers of our Constitution sat down at the convention in 1787, it hadn't even been 5 years since they'd been fighting a tyrant by the name of King George III in Britain. And they were very wary of creating a new tyrant in their new Constitution. In fact, the arguments over Article II, the part of the Constitution that established the presidency, were some of the most vociferous in the entire Constitutional Convention. Now, eventually, the framers created an office that they thought balanced that concern with the concern that whoever was president had to have enough power to be energetic and to actually do his job. And for much of our history, that balance was properly struck, or at least it was according to Professor David Adler of Boise State University. In fact, he is the director of the Andrews Center for Public Policy at Boise State, and he's a constitutional scholar in his own right. But David Adler's very concerned that somewhere along the way, somewhere along about 1950, we started losing our way. We started not striking the proper balance between the president on the one hand and especially Congress on the other. I sat down with David recently when I was in Washington, D.C., and the two of us talked all about this perennial issue.
I think my biggest concern, Stuart, is that over the past half century, we've seen presidential power rise and increase exponentially far beyond the framers' design for that office. And it's a function of a number of events that have occurred in the world going back to the Cold War. It's a reflection in part of the war on terrorism. But the long and the short of it is that the framers of the Constitution, I think, would not recognize the presidency that they created in 1787, because in their time, that generation, you recall, had just fought a war against a king whom they viewed as a tyrant, and their experience and their far-ranging readings suggested to them that, in fact, executive power represented a threat to their liberties. And so that deep-seated fear of executive power drove the men in the Constitutional Convention to create a sharply limited president, second to Congress, not only in domestic affairs, but also, interestingly, in the area of foreign affairs. And so many of your listeners might be surprised to know that when it came to the most awesome decision that any government could ever make, the decision to go to war, the framers gave that power, that constitutional authority, to Congress, not the president, and that they also vested the lion's share of authority over foreign affairs in Congress, not the president. So many might be surprised to hear that, because we now live in a world where we're accustomed to hearing from presidents and their supporters, and frankly, many members of Congress, that in fact, the president as commander-in-chief has the Army and the Navy available to answer to him, to carry out any mission that he would project, and indeed that, in fact, the president is charged with the responsibility to carry out American foreign policy. And so I think it's important that the American people understand that in this day and age, we have turned the Constitution on its head.
Indeed, in the 19th century, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the 19th century, with a couple of notable exceptions, Congress really was sort of the lead federal branch. The great debates took place in Congress, and the presidents of much of that era, especially perhaps the late 19th century, you just don't really hear that much about, because they were following the lead of Congress.
That's right, and that's exactly as the constitutional design provided. In fact, early presidents, all the way until Harry Truman, Stuart, had the understanding that the Constitution granted those important powers to Congress and not the president. So it was not until Harry Truman that for the first time in American history, any president laid claim to a unilateral power to take the nation into war. It's pretty late in our history.
Well, let's go through with them. What exactly prompted Harry Truman to go off the reservation, as it were, to go beyond the pale?
when Truman decided to deploy troops into Korea, thrusting the United States into what was then a civil war, he was no doubt propelled by his concern about spreading communism, and he wanted to take quick action. He also understood that the American people were very weary from the long sacrifices that they had endured under World War II, probably did not want to engage in yet another war, and so he didn't want to make a big deal of it. And that's why when he plunged American troops into Korea, he did not go to Congress for authorization, either a formal declaration of war or authorization for military hostilities, which is what the Constitution requires, but instead, as you know, simply referred to it as a police action, hoping that he would place this military action underneath the radar. Didn't happen, of course. And
now, his justification, if I recall, was that, of course, we had a treaty, the United Nations. Mm-hmm. We had a function through the Security Council of the United Nations. Mm-hmm. The Security Council had authorized the use of force to respond to the North Korean offensive. And, of course, through Article 6, treaties are among the highest laws in the land, along with the Constitution. So wasn't that enough justification? Wasn't he acting constitutionally at that point?
Well, that's a fascinating question. The chronology here is important. The fact of the matter is that he sent troops into Korea before he sought UN authorization. So that meant that, from his viewpoint, he stood on constitutional ground, both as commander-in-chief and under the executive power clause to send troops in.
But we were under fire, weren't we? I mean, I'm not defending Harry Truman. I just want to understand this. I mean, the North Koreans had come down the peninsula, and they were dry, and we had some few troops there, and they were actually engaging our troops, weren't they? So didn't he have a commander-in-chief Article 2 power to respond to that?
Well, actually not, because while that might be considered an act of war, at least an attack on troops, To engage in warfare requires, under the War Clause of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, that the President come to Congress for either a formal declaration of war or authorization of hostilities. And that was the framers' understanding. Until Truman's time, every President had followed that prescription. But Truman, for the first time, trotted out the Commander-in-Chief Clause as support for a unilateral presidential power to go to war. But that argument holds no water, given our constitutional architecture. Here's why in a 30-second nutshell.
Sure, go ahead.
The reality is that the framers decided that they could not vest in the hands of a single person the power to take the nation into war. James Wilson, a leading delegate from Pennsylvania, was famous for saying, "We have designed a system to, quote, prevent one man from hurrying us into war," because the framers recognized that the authority to go to war was a legislative, not an executive power. And the framers, by the way, did not invent that title, commander-in-chief. They borrowed it from the English, who had introduced it for the first time in 1639 in one of their several wars with the Scots. And they simply gave that title, commander-in-chief, to the ranking military official in any theater of battle. So there might be several commanders-in-chief. But that commander-in-chief was always subordinate to a political superior, the king, a member of the cabinet, or parliament. That practice was familiar to the Continental Congress when it appointed George Washington to be commander-in-chief. And on the day that it made that appointment, Congress provided to George Washington, quote, "You shall punctually respond to directions and instructions from Congress," again reaffirming the subordination of the commander-in-chief to Congress. And that understanding was so familiar to the framers in 1787 that I think that helps to explain why there was virtually no discussion on the commander-in-chief, and certainly no understanding or expectation that that would carry the war power. Federalist 69 supports the idea that Congress has the sole and exclusive authority to go to war. The President, in his role as Commander-in-Chief, may repel an invasion of the United States, or, in the alternative, when Congress has declared or otherwise authorized war, then the President puts on his hat as Commander-in-Chief and prosecutes the war, successfully, we hope. But at all events, in spite of the broad discretion that he enjoys in that capacity to prosecute the war, he is nevertheless responsible to carry out instructions imposed upon him by Congress. And the Supreme Court held upheld that point twice in the very early 19th century. And so the Commander-in-Chief Clause has never been viewed by the Supreme Court and not by any member of the Constitutional Convention or any member of the state ratifying conventions, and not identified as such in any of the contemporaneous writings surrounding the adoption of the Constitution. It was Harry Truman's contrivance.
That's fascinating. Okay, so mm-hmm. when the North Koreans come down, when the shots are fired, mm-hmm. The American troops are being driven back toward the Pusan perimeter, mm-hmm. the appropriate thing would have been constitutionally for Harry Truman to do what Franklin Roosevelt had done right after Pearl Harbor, is to go down Pennsylvania Avenue and say, we're under attack. What do you guys think? Should we declare war? That would have been the appropriate constitutional
thing. That's exactly right.
Okay, now in the meantime, you wouldn't object to our troops shooting back and defending themselves.
In fact, they have that right under international law, under the laws of war.
Okay, so we're not saying that American troops have to stand there and wait to pick up their rifles. Mm-hmm. They can defend themselves, but the first thing the president needs to do in a situation like that, where he's thinking about reinforcing them and escalating it and making it into a real conflict, rather, doing anything other basically than evacuating, mm-hmm. He needs to go to Congress and ask for a declaration of
That's
war.
That's exactly right, or an authorization. It's important to understand that the framers did not imply in any way that before we could use force that a formal declaration of war was required. The sort of declaration that we saw exercised, for example, six times in World War II. A declaration that the American people are declaring war against the Japanese people, against the German people, against the Italian people. A formal declaration can certainly be an alternative for Congress, but what's really required is that Congress, as a proper constitutional organ for making the decision between war and peace, can in fact exercise that authority through a joint resolution, for example.
Okay, so it doesn't matter as long as it's a majority.
That's exactly
basically
right.
But the majority of our elected representatives have to say we're going to go to war. Now, let me play devil's advocate. The counter-argument to that is that, especially in the modern era, with our far-flung commitments and our troops stationed all over the world, we can't wait for that. That we have to, the president has to be able to act nimbly and quickly, mm-hmm. responding to threats. He doesn't have time to go down the street, down Pennsylvania Avenue, and ask Congress for this. How do you respond to that?
And that's a frequently made argument. The reality is that there may be cases when our national interests are affected through our allies' actions or attacks on our allies. But the fundamental question remains, who in our constitutional system has the authority to decide when to initiate hostilities? That remains a congressional power. Even in the framers' time, there was an understanding that our allies might be under attack, and there would be the question, do we want to risk our blood and treasure? And in fact, Stuart, that question came up in Washington's cabinet. And to a man, the members of the cabinet agreed that even though we had what we would today call a mutual defense treaty with France, dating back to 1778, that would require the United States to come to the aid of France if France should be involved in war, when France began marauding throughout Europe in the early 1790s, the question came before the Washington cabinet, does the United States have an obligation under that treaty to respond to the request from France to come to her aid? And not even Alexander Hamilton, who was frequently identified, as you know, yeah. as an exponent of presidential power, would agree to do that, because he said in that case it would be France deciding when the United States should go to war and not the United States. So that very issue of the legal obligation that we have under a mutual defense treaty or a multilateral treaty came before the cabinet today. And so that goes back to your very first question about...
Yeah, but that's a little bit complicated by the fact that we signed a mutual defense treaty and then Napoleon comes along and starts marauding and all the rest mm-hmm. of it. What about a much purer circumstance, which arguably Korea was, at least once the UN mm-hmm. had done it? Can Congress prospectively exercise its declaration of war authority by entering into a mutual defense pact, which has fairly clearly defined conditions, which are then met? Let's say in NATO, for example, mm-hmm. there is actually an attack on a member country. Do we have to have Congress authorize us to go to war at that point, or have they already done so by ratifying the treaty?
That's a very important question. The answer is no. And that's because the treaty-making power, as you know, is a power exercised jointly by the President and the Senate. There's no role for the House of Representatives. And yet the War Clause of our Constitution requires an affirmative vote of both houses, the Senate and the House. So if a treaty could commit the United States to going to war, that would mean that decision would have been taken solely by the President and the Senate together with no role for the House. And that would not be consistent with our constitutional design. And that's exactly why then Washington's cabinet, addressing that question, determined that we cannot be drawn into war simply because we have formed a treaty. That in fact, we still need to follow the constitutional process, which is to get a vote from the House and the Senate.
Now, just let me make sure I understand then. You're not opposed to responding to immediate attacks, mm-hmm. you know, to our troops shooting back in one sense or another.
Right.
But your position is that at the earliest possible opportunity, and certainly before any major decisions are made to fully prosecute a war, mm-hmm. the president should get down to Congress and ask for a declaration or an authorization to go forward. And that the simple fact that Congress might take a little time to make that decision, or that it might ultimately disagree with that decision, those are not arguments against that.
That's exactly right. Number one, how a president perceives a potential or alleged emergency may be very different from the way Congress views it. And so if, in fact, there's a conflict of viewpoint on whether an emergency exists or whether a situation requires our military reaction to it, it's still a judgment call. And the Constitution places that judgment call in Congress, not the president. And there may be good reasons for moving slowly so that we have time to assess the information, to gather intelligence, make important judgments. But in addition to that, when we talk about a treaty obligating the United States to go to war, the question arises, well, what's the value of a defense treaty, of a mutual defense treaty, if we're in fact not obligated? The answer is that a country that forms a treaty with the United States and expects the United States to come to its aid and makes that call or makes that request may be disappointed if we don't respond, and it may have a cause at international law and may go before an international court. But the reality is our first obligation is to adhere to our Constitution. And that's why, for example, in 1945, Congress passed the UN Participation Act, which was the statute to enforce, to control our deployment of troops to meet a request from the UN to send troops into military battle or to carry out UN actions. But because there were so many in Congress who were fearful that call would effectively clothe the president with the unilateral authority to take the nation into war, that Congress provided in that statute that the decision to provide troops to the UN would be taken, quote, in accordance with our constitutional process. And the constitutional process, of course, is for Congress to make that decision. And both Secretary of State Dean Acheson and President Harry Truman at the time said that that was their understanding of what the UN Participation Act would mean. So there were no assertions at that time that joining the UN and answering a call from the UN for troops was in any way, shape, or form meant to imply that the president would have this unilateral authority to take the nation.
So why did old Harry do it then? Was he a closet monarchist? What's going on here?
I think that his fear, there were twin fears at least, the fear of the rising tide of communism and its implications for the United States, not merely in Korea, but throughout Asia. And at that point in time, of course, there was a perception, erroneous as it happens, that China and Russia might be acting as a monolithic bloc. So he was concerned about that. But secondly, I think he held real fears that if he put that question to Congress, Congress would not be willing to send the nation into war, not after our long period of sacrifice in World War II and the fact that the United States was just beginning to get back on its feet, so to speak, in the late 1940s. The nation was not ready for war, and so I think he sought to smuggle that in. And that's why he cleverly referred to this as a police action, not a war.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor David Adler, who's the director of the Andrews Center for Public Policy at Boise State University, all about presidential power. from the founding all the way up to the kill lists of today. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Professor David Adler. Stick around.
How many fools can I kill today? Too many to count, don't get in my way. I shoot a mofo in the throat with my bow. Tomahawk chop is my death. Freedom fighting machine, big ass hatchet in hand. Why'd you have to kill my bros? I'm a slasher face man. I'm a very skilled assassin, killing dudes in ones and twos. Blood flowing like a river, need a box of tissue. When I'm hunting, I be stunting, you can never find me in the bushes.
Well, it's that time again. Time for the constitutional quiz, and here with us, as always, is Kelly Carmichael, our quiz lady. Hello, Kelly.
Hello.
So what's new with you these days, Kelly?
Oh, you know, just coming up with as many tough quiz questions as I possibly can and just continually waiting for this time where we get to chat on the phone together.
Absolutely. I can just see you just wringing your hands in anticipation and cackling.
Tapping my fingers together as I wait for the next contestant.
Yes, indeed. And speaking of which, do we have a contestant?
Yes, sir. My name's Chris, and I'm from Lexington, Virginia.
Lexington, Virginia has to be one of the prettiest little towns in the entire Commonwealth.
I would have to agree with you there. Maybe one up you and say in the country. Beautiful little town.
It really and truly is. Now, it's home to not one, but two august educational institutions, is it not?
Absolutely. Washington and Lee University, as well as Virginia Military Institute.
Right. And if I recall from my last visit there, they're directly adjacent to one another, aren't they?
They are. And historically, it's created a little bit of tension as you have the military folk neighboring what they would consider a lot of times your sort of preppy, well-to-do kids that were vastly different backgrounds and experiences. And there was some tension throughout the years there between the two groups. But I think they're very amicable now.
I hope they're amicable because, you know, if it comes down to a physical altercation, I'm going to have to go with the soldiers. I'm afraid so. Well, Chris, we appreciate your playing today. Kelly, do you have a hard question for quiz?
Chris? As always.
Okay, what's the question today?
The preamble to the Constitution begins with the words, "We the people." These words mean, A, Americans were one people, B, the people approved of the new Constitution, C, the people wanted a better way of life, or D, it is the people who create government.
That's an interesting question. Could you repeat that, please?
The question is, the preamble to the Constitution begins with the words, "We the people." These words mean, A, Americans were one people, B, the people approved of the new Constitution, C, the people wanted a better way of life, or D, it is the people who create government.
Chris, I've had her repeat it. You've heard it twice now. Do you have any thoughts?
I'm gonna rule out B and C to start with, and I think it's between A and D.
Well, wait a second. Let's just be clear that we know what it is. You ruled out B, and that was that the people approved of it. Why is that not true?
I just don't think it makes sense that they, sort of went out person to person across the entire country and got pre-approval from everyone in the country, so I think that wouldn't be a correct answer.
Oh, so it's just a timing issue. Okay. What about C?
I don't remember the exact wording of that.
People wanted
a better way of life. So you're saying that people didn't want a good way of life?
they did, and I'm sure that was a reason for the revolution and for drafting a new and different form of government in the Constitution, but I don't think that that's what they meant to express there in that phrase. I'm thinking it's D, that they, that's kind of what was new or original and unique and special about it was that it was a government by the people and for the people. So I think that's first and foremost what they wanted to express more than anything, that this isn't being imposed upon the people. This is, created by them. So I think it's D.
That sounds pretty impressive. But before we settle on that one, what you said it was between D and A. What about A? The Americans are one people.
I think that it's great in thought or in theory, but I don't think in the minds of the people of the country at that time. I mean, you look at things like slavery and whatnot, that they really consider themselves one group in that sense. For one, and for two, I just think that D is a better answer. I think D, again, sort of illuminates the what's special about the Constitution, and that's what they wanted to get across there.
Geez, Kelly, Chris sounds pretty smart to me. What about you?
he is. Should we make him go out of his misery? Take him out of his misery?
Well, is that your final answer, Chris?
Yes, sir.
That's his final answer. I guess he's put him...
I really want that T-shirt, so tell me I'm right here.
Kelly, is he going to get a T-shirt?
You're going to get a T-shirt.
Hey,
congratulations, Chris.
Commander.
Yeah.
Chris, that was really impressive. I mean, you went straight down to the right answer, but... I think that's exactly it. This was the first time in Alexander Hamilton's famous phrase from the Federalist Papers that, in fact, that encapsulates the American experiment. You know, as he phrased it, the question is whether a people can, you know, come together and reason together and decide themselves what form of government they want rather than having one imposed upon them by some conqueror or king.
Well, the historical setting of it seems important, too, because you have a people that just revolted from that opposite sort of government. So I think to gain acceptance by the people that are sort of in that revolutionary mindset, very distrusting of government in general, I think it was very important that they communicate it in the way they did, that, you know, to get acceptance and to get people behind it and have this country sort of gain some cohesion. So,
Kelly, I'm getting kind of mad at Chris.
Should he take over your show, Stuart?
He keeps one-upping me. I'm the guy that's supposed to explain the context and the background, and every time I say something, he comes out with something better.
I guess you could go on vacation now, Stuart. You've been needing to take a vacation for a while.
I suppose so. I'll tell you what. You're just nailing it, Chris. Congratulations. And
I appreciate that.
You'll definitely get a T-shirt, and we'll give you a Constitution, too. I don't know if he really needs one. He already seems to know it all, but we'll give
everybody needs a Constitution.
Everybody needs
copies.
Absolutely. So you get a Constitution from James Madison's Montpelier, and it's a really nice one, a nice little green copy. It's nicely bound, and you'll get your T-shirt. So thank you for playing, Chris.
Thank you all, and thank you to Montpelier for helping put the program on. You guys have a good day.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor David Adler, the director of the Andrews Center for Public Policy at Boise State University, all about presidential power. Before the break, we were talking about President Truman and the fact that he seems to have been the first, in Professor Adler's opinion, the first president to have clearly exceeded his presidential war-making powers.
Well, this is getting worse and worse, because what I'm hearing is that Harry Truman specifically and intentionally subverted the Constitution for political reasons.
Yes, I think that's right.
He thought he knew better than the American people, and by golly, if we needed to go to war, he was going to take us to war, whether we would agree with it or not.
That's right, and by clothing this in the rhetoric of taking a strong position against communism, he knew that he would enjoy considerable political support in one sense, and that was these were the early days of McCarthyism. And of course, Joe McCarthy and others were rousing Americans' fears about the aims and the intentions of the Soviets and other communists. And so to take a position on a national security issue that would run counter to the position taken by the president that we need to engage in this military action to defeat the spread of communism would mean that people could be viewed, members of Congress and others could be viewed or painted as soft on communism. And of course, that becomes the proverbial lethal bullet in American politics in the 1950s. The best way to win office was to simply tout your anti-communist credentials, that you were stronger than your opponent.
Well, I'm sure it's not all Harry Truman's fault. So what else was it? What else has happened since that time to increase executive power at the expense of Congress and the rest of the government?
I think that's the important question to address. First, let me say that there were only a handful of members in the United States Congress that opposed Truman when he took the nation into Korea, one of whom was Robert Taft, senator from Ohio, who would have made a very fine president, many believe, but he had the misfortune to be running against a guy named Dwight Eisenhower in the Republican primary.
Yeah, not a good guy to run against.
The other, surprisingly, was Richard Nixon, who at that point in time said, look, the Constitution's very clear, only Congress can take the nation into war, not the president. He would later change his mind, as you know, during the Vietnam period.
Yes, he did.
But since then, every president except for Eisenhower has laid claim to unilateral presidential power to go to war. Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives alike, and with the exception of Eisenhower, then every president has gone down the path set forth by Harry Truman. And Congress has, for many different policy and political reasons, abdicated its responsibility to make those crucial decisions on war and peace, failed to defend its constitutional turf, and congressional abdication has simply facilitated the rise of presidential aggrandizement of the war power.
What are those reasons? Why would Congress not stand up to the president? Because of this McCarthyism? Because if you stand up to the president, you're going to be painted as weak?
Yep. I think initially that was one strong reason. The other was the point that you made earlier, and that was there was a perception that in order to defend American security interests, we need to act quickly. You can't handcuff the president. And that meant that the president should be able to act with speed and dispatch. Referring the matter to Congress would, of course, slow down the process, and then that might greatly imperil our security interests, particularly with respect to the Soviets. Those arguments took root, and then members of Congress, over time, began to realize that their own political fortunes were better served if they did not take the lead on these important issues involving war and national security, but followed the president's actions, which would, of course, give them the best of both worlds. If the president's actions were applauded by the American people, then members of Congress could join the applause. If presidential actions were criticized, members of Congress could join the chorus of criticism. That would protect them politically. And what we've learned over the years is, unfortunately, is that many, not all, but many members of Congress are primarily interested in promoting their own political careers. That's the plague of careerism on Congress. And if they perceive that participation in matters of war and national security and more broadly foreign affairs will undercut their efforts, then they don't find incentive to participate.
Well, they've got pretty good authority on that. I believe it was Abraham Lincoln who was defeated for the House of Representatives, and I think he attributed that to his vote against the Mexican War.
Lincoln made his mark as a freshman congressman, leading the cause to censor President Polk for unconstitutionally beginning that war. We don't find many freshmen members of Congress who are willing to take on a sitting president.
We don't find many Abraham Lincolns, do we?
That's right.
But he paid the price.
Well, I think that he had already made the agreement with his law partner, William Herndon, back in Springfield, that he would only go for a term. But of course, we know that that didn't quite quench Lincoln's political enthusiasm or ambition.
Right. Yeah. Still cost him politically, even if he was going to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, one thing we haven't mentioned from the same era, and I believe it was Gary Wills who wrote an entire book about it, was the advent of nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. What about that? Has that also increased executive power?
Yeah, that's a very important issue. The reality is that if the United States receives solid intelligence that an ICBM from a foreign country is en route, then, of course, the president would have the authority to respond as commander-in-chief to repel an invasion without going to Congress. And so in that case, we would hope that the intelligence is very, very solid, because in a retaliatory strike, we want to be retaliating, not initiating war, right? But the reality is, unfortunately, in this day and age, with the power of nuclear weapons, this nation could not absorb many strikes and continue to exist as a nation. So in some ways, that question becomes moot. Becomes the most difficult, most dire circumstance that we could discuss.
Yeah, there's really not any time for a declaration of war if you believe you're under nuclear attack. But I think Wills's point was, and it's been a while since I've read his book, so perhaps I'm stating it incorrectly, and I apologize if I am, but it's not merely that scenario. It's the simple fact that you've got these enormously, potentially civilization-ending weapons, and the power to own them, to possess them, to control them has devolved onto this one person, and that's such an awesome power in and of itself that it cloaks the office and the entire national security apparatus with a mystique and with secrecy. And with secrecy comes deference by the other branches of government. Well, those guys are taking care of those important bombs, and, you know, I guess we should just leave all those decisions to them.
Yes, that's right. And I think, first of all, our listeners should understand that if in our time you give to one person, the president, the authority to initiate war, which is the path we've been traveling since 1950, right, you are essentially giving to that one person the power to exterminate humankind. Because imagine the results of a nuclear war, the earth on fire, the incineration of the planet. That is a terrible image. If you allow your mind's eye to consider that for a moment, that is horrific beyond description. But that's the capacity of a single person. And that's why I think that even though the framers in 1787 could not have glimpsed nuclear weapons, that their reasoning for giving to Congress and not the president the authority to initiate war are actually more compelling today than they were in their time, simply because one person could not have eclipsed mankind with a particular weapon.
No, they certainly couldn't have. What were some of the other things that happened? Have we covered everything? Was it simply Truman's example, the so-called communist threat, the advent of nuclear weapons, the national security state? Was there any, and the abdication of Congress for political reasons? Were there any other reason that the presidency has taken on all this power?
Well, I think beyond the Cold War argument, of course, then as we moved into the War on Terror, mm-hmm, then the same arguments that propelled presidential unilateralism in the 1950s have now resurfaced and gained renewed currency ever since the attack on 9/11. And so Congress continues to abdicate, and we see the current controversies, including President Obama's decision to authorize the use of drone strikes, for example.
Before we get there, and that's very important because I do want to talk about that, yeah, I mean, we essentially, many people think, that we essentially followed the lead of the then president, George W. Mm-hmm. Bush, into two wars, one of which most people consider justified in retrospect, the one in Afghanistan, especially specifically against Al-Qaeda, who was then hiding there, and one of which many people have very serious doubts about, and that was the war in Iraq. And I'm guessing that that is your position, that if we'd actually had a debate that had been more fully and robustly conducted by Congress, where Congress was not worried so much about its own future careers, that maybe we would have had a different outcome?
I think that's very possible. It's hard to know because at that point in time, there was still so much fear, right, resonating throughout the country from the attack on 9/11, and justly so. And yet, additional concern about another attack and what we ought to do. That Congress did not, in fact, energetically engage in the kind of informed debate that the framers had expected Congress to do. Remember that when the framers decided to give the war power to Congress and not the president, they placed their great faith in the process of the crossfire of discussion and debate as a means of trying to arrive at a good policy. And that meant that a variety of issues from the four corners of the country would be brought center stage. And that's the kind of vigorous debate that ought to precede any decision to go to war because, as you know, when we go to war, we can't anticipate the twists and turns of warfare. And to make that most awesome decision to expend the blood and treasure of the United States should be one that's made only after the most solemn discussion and debate. We didn't have that before we went to Iraq. And if you consider what Congress did in the aftermath of 9/11 was that it passed shortly afterward the authorization to use military force, a statute that effectively authorized the president to go into war in Afghanistan, and a similar statute, the Iraqi resolution, which also authorized President Bush to invade Iraq. The chief problem, the real vice of those statutes is found in the fact that it represents an unconstitutional delegation of the war power, which is to say Congress is not making the choice between war and peace. In each statute, Congress allowed the president to make the choice to go to war. So when you look at the language, as you know, the authorization to use military force provides that the president is authorized to use force against all those organizations, individuals, and others whom he deemed to have been involved or supported. Well, that grant of decision-making authority to make the actual decision to go to war offends or violates the War Clause, which requires that Congress make the choice. So,
well, I have to play devil's advocate again, though. I mean, it's one thing when you know you're going to war against France, one thing when you're going to war against Germany or Italy. Here, the counterargument would be, we did not know exactly who had attacked us. We had to give a broad authority for the president to figure it out and to modify that as new intelligence came in. Mm-hmm. And moreover, these are non-state actors for the most part, so is even a declaration of war appropriate in these circumstances? How do you respond to those?
I think so, because as you pointed out, President Bush and his team had to decide that the attack had come from Afghanistan, and so at some point he decided he had adequate intelligence to make the decision to deploy troops and go to war. Well, that same process then could have occurred, and then he could have come to Congress, spread the evidence, just as James Madison did, for example, in the War of 1812, when he laid before Congress the evidence that the British had engaged in numerous acts of war, and he recommended to Congress that it decide for war, but it left that that question to Congress. Bush could have done the same thing. And look, in that day and age, I don't think either of us would doubt that Congress would have authorized the hostilities. Then we would have had a resolution that would have met constitutional concerns. And the point is, Congress, not the president, would have been making the decision.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor David Adler of Boise State University, who's telling me, give me a great historical overview of the development of what many people call the imperial presidency, and specifically the power of the president to make war. After the break, we'll have our This Week at Montpelier, and then we'll come back and finish our discussion with Professor David Adler. Stay tuned. So, Kelly Carmichael, what's happening this week at Montpelier?
Everybody together, happy birthday to you.
Whose birthday?
Dolly Madison!
Happy
it's
birthday.
Dolly's birthday.
Dolly, of course, a big day at Montpelier.
Yes, it's
How old would she be today if she were still with us? Do you know? 200?
A lady never wants to admit
of
her
course
age,
not.
Stuart.
She's 29.
She is 29
again. All right, tremendous.
I'm going on 29 still.
There we are, yes. I celebrated that at least once, maybe twice now. I don't know. Okay, so what is the actual date of Dolly Madison's birthday celebration?
May 18th is going to be the birthday celebration. We're going to celebrate her birthday and why she deserved the title First Lady. And we have birthday cake and punch, and Dolly will be here that day, and free admission for anybody who shares Dolly Madison's name or birthday. So if your first name is Dolly or it's your birthday, you get free admission.
If your birthday, now, is that her actual birthday, the 18th, or is that just the day it's being celebrated? I mean, what I want to know is, do I have to have a birthday on Saturday, May the 18th?
You do.
Okay, so that's it. So that's the relevant date. My birthday is on May 18th.
Her actual real birthday is May 20th, but we're celebrating on Saturday.
Well, that's the question.
You know,
then.
Stuart, I bet there's a loophole there.
You could be either May 18th or May 20th.
Or the 20th, because we're celebrating the 18th. You know,
you could make an argument.
Yeah, you could make an argument.
Not that we're encouraging anybody to.
Not that I would encourage anybody. And
Yeah.
My name's really not Kelly. I don't really work at Montpelier.
The rule is ambiguous. Therefore, we must construe it in favor of the non-drafting party. So that means if you have the 18th or the 20th of May, come on down. You're getting in free, right?
And regardless, come down, have cake, punch, and go learn about our first lady.
Tremendous. Where can people sign up for this, or do they need
just
to?
Just come. Show up.
Saturday, May the 18th, what time?
All day.
Yeah. So show up on Saturday, May the 18th.
But it looks like the punch and the birthday cake will be more in the morning, early morning, afternoon.
Okay. Early morning,
morning and early afternoon.
So late morning, early afternoon. What time does Montpelier open on a typical Saturday?
9 a.m.
Just show up at 9 a.m. You'll make sure you get your cake.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kelly.
Bye.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now let's finish our discussion on presidential power with Professor David Adler. Before the break, David was talking about the authorization for use of military force and the declaration of our intention to invade Iraq.
Okay, so it was premature.
I think so.
Is what it was. It was just premature. I mean, everyone understands you want to respond quickly after 9/11.
Yes.
But maybe we should have waited till we had a little bit better idea what we wanted to do. And then the president goes and asks specifically for a specific authority against a specific enemy, as opposed to an open-ended resolution.
Yeah, the process of deciding to go to war would not have been different, because the same information that the Bush administration gathered to make that decision to invade Afghanistan would have been the very information that he would have presented to Congress, and he would have asked for authorization to go to war, and there would not have been a delay. Not given the mood of the country at that time, with very clear evidence indicating who had attacked the United States. So we would not have had the problem of delay. And so when the argument is sometimes used that we can't wait for Congress to decide, there would have been no waiting. It would not have been different, for example, than the waiting time that occurred between the request from President Roosevelt after the attack on Pearl Harbor and when Congress declared war. It was almost instantaneous.
Yeah, that seems to be sort of the answer to those who would say that Congress can't act quickly. I think the evidence is if Congress feels like there's a clear threat, Congress will act with great dispatch.
That's exactly right.
Okay. In fact, I can actually imagine an alternate reality. If there had been no premature, as you say, authorization for use of military force, and the president had gathered intelligence, figured out it was al-Qaeda, figured out that they were resident in Afghanistan at that time, figured out that Afghanistan's government, the Taliban-controlled government, was being recalcitrant, was not willing to address our concerns, then the declaration might actually have been against Afghanistan.
Exactly.
Okay, it would have been against another state, and it would have included, you know, the mandate to go in and clean out those who are being harbored there. Mm-hmm. That would have been a much more contained, more traditional declaration of war, much less open-ended.
I think so, and it would have swept away the concerns that I just aired, which is to say the unconstitutional delegation of the war power to the president to use force against anybody whom he deems to have been involved or supported or assisted becomes an open-ended grant of authority, almost a blank check to the president to take military action against anybody, anytime, anywhere, if he can associate them with the attack on 9/11. And that becomes the problem that we're facing today.
I have to interrupt you again. I want to get there. I really want to get there. But Iraq. I mean, the argument made by those who at least currently oppose the Iraq war, what we did there is that the president, perhaps completely in good faith, or if you prefer, perhaps not, decided for whatever reason that he was going to say that Saddam Hussein had somehow been connected with the attacks, somehow additionally presented some additional threat with weapons of mass destruction, for example, somehow tied that in to the authorization for use of military force and moved forward with it. Now, there was an additional authorization, though, wasn't there?
There was the Iraqi resolution.
Right.
And President Bush could easily have done that. He could have come to Congress and indicated, we have evidence that Hussein was involved in the attack on 9/11. He also harbors weapons of mass destruction. We have intelligence indicating he's going to use them against the United States. That would have been a pat case. And Congress would have responded, I believe, by authorizing it after having a vigorous discussion and debate. Now, what we would have hoped for would be that members of Congress would ask the right questions. How good is your intelligence?
Right.
Right? Those kinds of questions so that it could get as clear as possible.
What was the timeline on the Iraqi resolution?
Just a matter of months, because remember, we invaded in March after the
right,
resolution.
Yeah, but I'm saying, was there actually, I mean, the authorization for use of military force was soon after 9/11.
Right.
Okay, and then how long after that was the Iraqi resolution?
In early 2003.
Okay.
So a couple months, two or three months.
Okay, yeah. And it was, but in your mind, that, or from your position, that Iraqi resolution was still premature. And should have, again, waited until the evidence was in, until we could have had the robust debate.
Yes, and the virtue of doing that, from the president's standpoint, is that if he had spread the evidence, and Congress had engaged in this vigorous debate, and the United States as a nation had decided to go to war, instead of President Bush deciding, then that would have meant that President Bush would not have taken all of the criticism once the war went south, or rather, once the premises for going to war unraveled. And
right.
Of course, the White House later recanted. And so that's why President Eisenhower was so wise in disavowing a unilateral presidential power to go to war. He did it on two grounds, political and policy. He said, if the United States is going to go to war, then we should understand the risk we're undertaking, and he better understood those risks than virtually anybody in American history. He said, let's have joint decision making. Let's have the Congress and the President on board. Why should I take that risk politically? And why should I be walking the plank if things go south? So he's a very wise man, and that wisdom would have well served his successors and also certainly President Bush.
Indeed. All right. Well, finally now, we're to the present day then. Now we have a president who was elected to some extent based upon his criticisms of the Bush administration, including some of the things that we've discussed here, who now has asserted the power to unilaterally sit down on apparently a weekly or monthly basis with what's been colloquially called a kill list and decide, okay, I'm going to kill this fellow, I'm going to kill that fellow, I don't think I'll kill this fellow, at least not this week, and go ahead and launch some drones. That, to me, is an extraordinary power. I mean, it's not as awesome in the sense of nuclear weapons. I mean, it's not civilization ending, okay? But just in its particulars, the idea that the president could be sitting across from a general like you and I are sitting here right now, and they could literally be looking at a list and saying, kill this one, kill that one, that seems to me to be so beyond what the founders ever thought a president would do. I'm sure you, I can see you nodding, I'm sure you agree.
I certainly do, and the reality is that was the framers' worst nightmare, that a single individual could make the decision to take the nation to war or make the decision to use military force against individuals or certain organizations, because the framers had encountered those same problems during their period, during their lifetimes. Here's the problem, and this goes back to the authorization to use military force enacted by Congress after 9/11. Because President Bush was able to cite that statute as authority to use force, and by the way, when he reported to Congress, while he acknowledged that, he still claimed his independent authority as commander-in-chief. So like his predecessors, he's not ready to let go of that argument. But nonetheless, that statute has been cited by the Obama administration as authority to use drones to strike those people whom the president deems to have been involved in 9/11 or otherwise assisted or supported. This is the problem with the open-ended, almost blank check of authority. And if the president is going to invoke that statute as authorization, it seems to me that it might, that it would be permissible in Afghanistan. But as setting aside the concerns about the fact that it's an unconstitutional delegation of war, at least the president is purporting to ground his actions in that statute in Afghanistan. But when the president then decides to unleash drone attacks in other countries, Yemen, Somalia, etc., that is taking that authorization to use military force as authorization to make war on any monsters that he might perceive anywhere in the world at any time. That is the perfection of unilateral presidential war making, which the war clause was designed to prevent.
Yeah, and it goes beyond that. It's not just in foreign countries. I mean, right now we're having a debate about the Boston Marathon suspect, and there are those who are calling for the president to unilaterally declare him to be an enemy combatant, despite the fact that he's an American citizen, despite the fact that the crime occurred, the incident, if you want to call it an act of war crime, whatever, happened on American soil, despite the fact that he has been captured by our police and that the Article III courts are all open for business, despite all of those things, there are those who are calling for him to be treated as a military, an enemy combatant, and then theoretically, I guess the president could just call a drone strike in on his hospital bed.
That's right. That's a very nice question, because that really raises the issue of the limits, if any, placed on presidential use of force. The reality, of course, is, I believe, is that the administration, the Justice Department, made the right call to charge him, to bring him.
Yeah, they're not going to do that.
They're not going to do that.
I'm simply saying there are those who are extending the argument that
far. Exactly right. And they probably do so unwittingly. So when senators, several senators, as you pointed out, called for Obama to declare the Boston Marathon bomber as an enemy combatant, I think they weren't quite cognizant of the implications of their reasoning, because then it would extend to the possibility that a president could use force against you, against me, against anyone here on American soil. And of course, that boggles the mind. And so the reality is that the design for the use of force, as established by the framers, still fits our world. Because it doesn't matter if we're looking at a crisis here in America or a perceived crisis abroad, it still requires some discussion and debate by Congress to decide whether to use force. And if we're going to allow the president to declare people enemy combatants, when in fact they can be tried by a civilian court, then we have just circumvented Article 3. We have greatly enhanced the executive authority of the President of the United States. And again, we've pushed Congress to the sidelines. And so we see the steady march toward unilateral executive power.
We've given the President a magic wand that he can just say, poof, I declare that you're an enemy combatant, and I've thereby stripped you of most, if not all, of your constitutional rights.
It's an ongoing problem of the imperial presidency, a concept which, as you know, took flight in the 1960s under Johnson and Nixon. And even though it has at times flown at a somewhat lower altitude under caretaker presidents like Jerry Ford and Jimmy Carter, it's never touched ground. It remains aloft. And in fact, I think it's very clear that under President Bush and President Obama, that it's soaring at a higher trajectory than ever, because there have been, in some ways, unprecedented claims by executives to new powers. And so we still face this problem of the imperial presidency and trying to draw limits around this.
Indeed we do. And you mentioned Richard Nixon. That reminded me of his notorious interview with the interviewer David Frost. And I'm sure you've seen this. You're nodding, where he essentially said, if the president does it, that makes it legal.
Yes.
And you told me a few minutes ago that he didn't start out that way. I mean, he was a very, very bright guy. I think he was first in his class at Duke Law School or something.
Yeah.
This guy knew the Constitution, and at least before he got a little too presidential in his perspective, he realized that there was some kind of limit on what the president could do. And then later on, he seems to have really drunk the Kool-Aid. And I wonder if all of our presidents, Republican and Democrat, as you say, they're all flying this power fairly high, and they all seem to just, maybe for the best of intentions. You know, I got to protect the country. I need this power. But they've all taken this power on themselves. How do we fix this?
I think that's a great question to ask. Let me say the first thing I think is for Americans to understand that so long as they want fixes, they want responses, they want answers to all of our questions and answers to all of our needs, and they look to the president as the savior, presidents are going to assume the power, constitutional or not, to meet those expectations, because presidents are political animals. Often they're running for a second term. The last thing they want to do is to fail to meet the expectations of the public, because that will spell doom. So one of the things that the American citizenry needs to understand, I believe, is to develop a better understanding about the responsibilities and powers of Congress. And they are many. They are very, very broad, so that we take our concerns and express our needs to that body, which has the constitutional tools and responsibilities to address those problems, and not to the president. So part of the problem here is a failure on the part of the American citizenry to understand the Constitution. And programs like yours do a great job in educating the public.
Well, we hope so.
And so if we better understand that it's to Congress that we should be making many of our requests and not the president, that would, I think, serve to instill in members of Congress a deep-seated responsibility to act.
Well, David Adler of Boise State University and the director of the Andrus Center for Public Policy, thank you very much for being on your weekly Constitutional.
It's been my pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Professor David Adler of Boise State University for that fascinating discussion of presidential power, all the way from the Constitutional Convention to the kill list. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.